extinction events on our planet, though many individual species must have been lost. However, this time is different. In the past, climate change was usually much more gradual, and species could gradually shift their ranges in response, shifting towards the poles as the climate warmed and returning towards the equator as it cooled. Such movement used to be easy, for there were vast tracts of suitable habitat. Today, to move polewards, insects must somehow hop from one patch of habitat to the next, crossing roads, landscapes filled with polluting factories, arable fields sprayed with insecticides, housing estates, and other alien human-made landscapes. Insects do not live in isolation, but depend upon particular plants to provide food for their larvae, or nectar and pollen for adults. If these plants haven't traveled ahead of them, for example, via seeds blown on the wild, then they cannot survive. So, entire communities of organisms need to make this journey. It seems that they are failing to do so. Studies of bumblebees in North America and Europe have revealed that they are disappearing from the southern edges of their ranges as the climate becomes too warm for them. But the northern edges of their ranges have not moved northward, as we might expect. It has been described as a climate vice, the ranges of the bees being gradually squashed from the south. Some mountain-dwelling bumblebees in Colorado and Spain have responded to climate warming by moving higher in the mountains, but eventually they will run out of mountain and be left with nowhere else to go. Studies of these mountain bees have also revealed that climate change may disrupt the seasons in subtle but important ways. Many insects time their life cycle carefully to ensure that times of activity coincide with availability of a vital resource. As the climate warms, different organisms may use different cues to time their life cycle, leading to mismatches. For example, some mountain plants in Colorado are now coming into flower before the bumblebees that feed on them have emerged from hibernation, meaning that the plants are not pollinated and set few seed. Bumblebees seem to be particularly sensitive to warming as they are creatures found primarily in cool, temperate climates. Their large size and fairy coats are adaptations to keeping warm in cool conditions, and they literally overheat in hot weather. Above all the 30 degrees Celsius, most bumblebees species seem unable to maintain prolonged activity. The recent heat waves that afflicted much of Europe's temperatures, even in the UK, exceeded 40 degrees Celsius, leaving bumblebees unable to gather food for extended periods. Are bumblebees an exception? Many other insects are more thermophilic, warmth-loving, and thrive in hot climates. For example, many butterflies are at the northern edge of their range in the UK, so we might expect them to benefit from a warmer climate. To test this, the Charity Butterfly Conservation analyzed changes in the populations of 46 butterfly species that all reached the northern edge of their range in the UK, the species we would expect to be enjoying warming. Between 1970 and 2000, three-quarters of these species declined significantly. The pattern differs between sedentary habitat specialists, fussy species with very specific requirements, and low mobility, comprising 28 species, and the generalist, highly mobile species, 18 species. Of the habitat specialists, 89% had declined, while only half of the generalists had declined, and a few, including pest species, were thriving. This gives us a clue as to why climate warming has so far not benefited even warmth-loving butterflies. Mobile generalists can more easily move in response to warming and are more likely to find somewhere where they can survive when they get there. Of course, climate change is not simply a matter of slight increases in temperatures. Perhaps more impactful on wildlife is the increased frequency of extreme weather events such as droughts, heat waves, wildfires, storms, and floods, all of which are likely to become more frequent and more extreme in the future. We have little idea what impact these will have on insects, but of course, very few of them will be positive. Fires will obviously kill insects, although the flush of new flowers that follows fires in some ecosystems would benefit some. Summer storms are likely to batter delicate adult insects such as butterflies, and flash floods are likely to destroy underground nests of creatures such as bumblebees. Drought causes water stress plants to cease nectar production in their flowers, which will certainly harm pollinators. In prolonged droughts, plants wilt and become unpalatable for caterpillars. For example, in the hot British summer of 1967, many caterpillars of the Adonis blue butterfly died as their food plant, horseshoe wedge, shriveled in the heat. As a result, numbers of the adults were much lower in the following year, and some populations died out. With the UK now experiencing the worst drought since 1967, it is a fair bet that 2023 will be an especially poor year for butterflies. Although climate change is undoubtedly bad news for many insects, there is no doubt that some are thriving. Ironically, these tend to be undesirables from a human perspective. Adaptable mobile species that can thrive in urban landscapes, such as houseflies and mosquitoes, are on the increase. For example, the yellow fever mosquito seems to have adapted well to urbanization and thrives in cities, breeding in blocked gutters, discarded tires, barrels, buckets, and any other human refuse that traps puddles of water. It is one of the main vectors of several nasty diseases, including dengue fever, Zika fever, and of course yellow fever, as its name suggests. The Anopheles mosquito, the main transmitter of malaria, is also benefiting from the spread of human activities. Cases of malaria tend to become more frequent in areas where forests are cleared for agriculture because the mosquito likes to breed in sunlit puddles and ditches, which are hard for it to find in dense forests. Climate predictions suggest that malaria is likely to spread to higher altitude regions of the tropics, for example, in Colombia, Kenya, and Ethiopia. These regions are densely populated with humans in part because, until recently, they were largely free from malaria. The southern states of the U.S., southeastern Europe, parts of China, and the densely populated areas surrounding the Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro in Brazil are also likely to become suitable for malaria by 2050. Dengue fever is similarly predicted to become far more common throughout North America, as for North and Southern Canada. Clearly, we need to place tackling climate change as the single most urgent priority for humankind, both for the sake of the astonishing biodiversity on our planet and for our own well-being. Preserving as much nature-rich habitat as possible and attempting to link habitat patches together may help insects and other wildlife to cope in the meantime. Midstream.
Loose titles, ill-defined narration, and accusations lacking evidence. This is, in one sentence, the summary of the new but old Western media frenzy against the Islamic Republic of Iran in an attempt to push yet again for the same regime change tactics. Get this. Many pro-color revolution Western websites published this part of the news narrative. Mahsa Amini died after falling into a coma following her arrest by the morality police in Tehran because of her inappropriate dress. But hold on a second. Did the Iranian young woman die the moment the police arrested her? Or was she in shock after being arrested by the police for a felony she had committed according to Iranian law, but having been suffering from chronic disease her entire life, which led to her tragically passing away? The news did not mention that Amini was subjected to any torture. How did she pass away then? A day after Amini's death, Iranian police released a video captured by a CCTV camera documenting the young woman's last moments inside the police station. The footage proves that Mahsa Amini, 22, was not subjected to any violence or physical abuse. The clip shows the Iranian young woman inside the morality police station as she was standing next to a bench, talking to another woman, then suddenly grabbing her head, crashing into a bench, and falling to the ground. At the end of the video, she was taken on a stretcher to the ambulance and from there to the hospital. Iranian police said that Amini suddenly suffered from heart failure in the presence of other people and was immediately taken to the hospital in an emergency situation for treatment, but she sadly did not make it. In addition to the rumors and conflicting narratives that spread after this politically appetizing issue, as some activists called it, a series of global condemnations and denunciations began. The White House said Amini's death was a flagrant and appalling violation of human rights, and the United Nations expressed their usual concern. The European Union considered that what happened to the Iranian girl was unacceptable, while France considered Amini's death shocking. Within hours, news websites and social media platforms were filled with articles, blogs, and TV episodes discussing Mahsa Amini's death, as well as video analysis explaining how she died, directing public opinion against Iran, pushing direct incitement, clear mobilization, and discussion of public and individual freedoms in Tehran. Mind you, the United States of America incarcerates far more of its population per capita than any other country in the world. The UK incarcerates journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and prepares to extradite him to the US straight to the hands of the CIA. And the French Senate passed an amendment last year that bans girls under 18 from wearing the hijab in public, prevents mothers from wearing hijabs on their children's school trips, and bans the burkini, a full-body swimsuit. But hold your horses. The UN is worried about women's rights in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The tragic death of the Iranian young woman Mahsa Amini turned into a fake news bomb that perfectly fits for the bright headlines of the Western mainstream media. A quick scroll through Google search engine, it becomes clear how the media dealt with the death of the Iranian young woman. Loose titles, ill-defined narration, and accusations lacking evidence. In addition to the rumors and conflicting narratives that spread after this politically appetizing issue, typically a series of global condemnations and denunciations began, starting with the blatant hypocrisy of Washington to always so concerned UN, who happens to have never showed any concern for the millions of Iranians suffering from Washington's illegal unilateral punitive measures. To discuss this issue with us from Washington is Jesse Zurwell, writer, editor, researcher, and producer and host at TNT Radio. Thank you for being with us, Jesse. Now, rioters during the recent wave of violence on the streets of several Iranian provinces not only disrupted public security and trashed their own cities, they went as far as terrorism, cutting and slitting the throats of security officers, of Iranian police officers who tried to retain safety and security to the streets of their country. How far do you think this very suspicious wave of violence is going to go in Iran?
It's hard to say how far it will go, but I think it will go as far as those who are responsible for this chaos want it to go, unless and until the authorities in Iran put a stop to it, which they've been trying to do since the very beginning. And as you said, they've met with outright violence, from vandalism and fires and actual rioting to the cutting of throats of police officers or law enforcement, which is not something that one would typically associate with Iranians who care about their country, who care about the rule of law. What is happening has all the hallmarks of a color revolution in service of regime change. And though we don't know for sure who is behind this, we can make some very good guesses as to who is responsible. And as we know from past experiences, they will stop at nothing unless they are stopped or they achieve their aims. I don't think they will achieve their aims, as has been the case in the past. But again, they will take this as far as they feel necessary to take it, unless and until they are stopped by Iranian authorities.
Well, Jesse, it's not new nor surprising to actually see how Western mainstream media is taking advantage of the recent situation in Iran, claiming all sorts of humanitarian violations while they persecute their own people at home against free speech, to say the least, and while they take part in normalizing the West's brutal unilateral punitive measures against Iran and against other countries as well. And they do that without even flinching. They don't care. But what I want to know is, are there any real ripples inside the U.S. Society, at the public level, I mean, concerning this new wave of attack against Iran? Are the public really believing what their regime is trying to portray of the Iranian state?
I'm sad to say that at the public level here in the U.S., it's barely making an impact, if any impact at all. Most people are not aware of what's happening in Iran right now. And if they are, they're not paying attention very closely to it outside of what's being spewed by the likes of the corporate media, likes of CNN and Fox News, which has been ad nauseum to suggest, to declare that the Iranian state is carrying out violence against its citizens, that the Iranian state murdered the young woman in question, when there's clear evidence that that is not what happened. The situation in Europe, as opposed to the U.S., there seems to be a bit more awareness. There seems to be more propaganda in public and a public that is willing to fall for the propaganda. But here in the U.S., it comes primarily through corporate media, and people, if they care at all, pay attention just to what is told to them by corporate media and do no more research than
How do people like you, Jesse, get to know what is going on, and where do you get your news from?
Well, speaking for myself, I go to Iranian sources, I go to Press TV, of course, and I go to various independent media sources that actually are paying attention to what's happening in Iran and paying attention to it in a way that is not just regurgitating state propaganda. That said, it's still difficult to get an exact picture as to what's going on, but if you pay attention to corporate media, you're getting a very distorted, I would say completely inaccurate picture of what's going on.
What we saw and we are still seeing in Iran at maybe a lower pace than what happened during the past few days is a page from the Color Revolution Manual 101 that we have seen for the past at least 15 years, from riots to violence against security personnel to killing civilians and claiming that the authorities actually did it. This is exactly what we saw in Daraa in Syria in 2011, and before that in Ukraine and in Georgia. But with all that is going on right now with the world, and we are literally two steps behind World War III. What good does the U.S. really think it can get from instigating such an unrest, knowing that Iran is honestly not Syria?
I don't know. The U.S. is certainly playing with fire with regard to Iran. It's not in an economic position to be waging such warfare, really, against Iran, economic warfare and regime change warfare. And perhaps this is at the behest of Israel. We certainly need to ask that question. And we need to ask to what extent the EU and UK are involved in this. It's very, very suspicious that this comes right after Iran was formally welcomed into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and it comes at a time when the president of Iran is speaking before the UN General Assembly. Certainly, Iran is making moves on the world stage to try to benefit itself. And since the revolution in 1979, the US and the broader West has stood completely against any sort of self-determination on the part of Iran. So it seems to me that what the U.S. is trying to do here is what it's always been trying to do, though it's certainly upped the game. It's using more intense tactics than it has in the past, but it seems unlikely to succeed because Iran knows how to deal with this sort of chaos, this provocation, but time will tell.
Definitely. They have been through this before, but they were able to bypass all of the attempts by the U.S. to wreak havoc and disturb the security in Tehran and elsewhere, in other provinces as well in Iran. Thank you very much, Jesse Zurwal, writer, editor, researcher, and producer and host at TNT Radio, for being with us and for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will talk about something that the mainstream media did not mention. They ignored the U.S. occupation's killing of a young Iraqi teenager.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, in Iraq, a teenage girl named Zainab Isam Al-Khaz'ali was killed because of a stray bullet from an American occupation base situated inside Baghdad's international airport. It's not enough that the Americans are illegally residing as a form of occupation inside the international airport of a supposedly sovereign state, yet they blatantly use live ammo while fully aware that the airport is encircled by civilian residential neighborhoods, leading to the murder of a young Iraqi teenager named Zainab Al-Khaz'ali. Iraqis are infuriated by the crime. They demanded their authorities to investigate the cowardly incident that affected all families in the village of Abu Alwan in the Abu Ghraib area amid a total media blackout. U.S. occupation kills Iraqi teenager in this following report.
The killing of the 15-year-old girl Zainab Isam al-Khaz'ali in the Abu Ghraib area west of the capital Baghdad by an alleged stray bullet sparked a wave of anger on social media platforms in Iraq. Politicians and activists accused U.S. occupation forces of killing the girl while training in a nearby camp. The bullet ended the life of the young woman, Zainab, as a result of a gunshot wound that came from a military shooting range near the village of Bu Alwan in Abu Ghraib district. For its part, the Baghdad Operations Command decided to open an investigation into the death of the teenage girl. The Iraqi security media cell said in a statement that the competent authorities supervising the course of investigation will announce to public opinion its reasons and will take the necessary legal measures against anyone who is proven to be involved in this incident. Iraqi politicians and bloggers accused the U.S. occupation forces of killing Zainab, and one of the most prominent tweets on that matter was attributed to the Secretary General of Asaib Ahlul Haq, Qais al-Khaz'ali, who demanded an immediate investigation into the killing of the girl. The hashtag America Killed Zainab became trending, and this came based on the testimony of the people of the region in a video clip circulating on social media platforms that the bullet came from a training camp inside Baghdad International Airport, in reference to the American Victoria occupation base located inside the airport. The martyrdom of the Iraqi girl Zainab, shot by the American occupation forces in Baghdad, does not seem to be passing unnoticed inside Iraq. The public are demanding government agencies investigate the cowardly, treacherous incident that affected Iraqi families in the village of Al Bu Alwan in the Abu Ghraib area. Meanwhile, Iraqis were not the slightest surprised that the Western mainstream media remained silent about this crime while it is dancing nonstop to the tune of regime change in Iran. Western and regional media hypocrisy does not surprise any of the natives of West Asia, those who are with a one-eyed humanity. How many times have we seen them rising up for shenanigans under the pretext of human rights and keeping silent about the massacres of the occupation, be it the American or the Zionist occupation? The silence of the media, activists, and politicians who were tweeting round the clock attempting to incite civil war in Iraq not so long ago are nothing less than partners in crime to the repetitive crimes of the American occupation, not only in Iraq, but across all the world.
To discuss this tragedy with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Julia. Now, if you want to know how Zainab died, by browsing the news, we will often read this specific piece of information. It says, a stray bullet ended the life of young Zainab as a result of a gunshot wound coming from a military shooting range near the village of Al Bu Alwan. A gunshot wound originating from a military shooting range. This is what it said. This means that the killer is known or the suspect is well-defined, but the news is incomplete and is not clear from an editorial point of view, at least, to say. Military shooting range belonging to whom? Does a stray bullet, Julia, take responsibility instead of a shooter?
You answered the question yourself, Marwa. The military range shooting was... the language for that is intentionally obscured because it is a site of the U.S. occupation, which is illegally in Iraq, which is illegally established its presence in Iraq decades ago and refuses to leave despite the will of the Iraqis. So while the media can obfuscate the accountability and the responsibility by trying to claim that a stray bullet did not intentionally kill Zainab Isam, it still is indicative when the mask of the language is uncovered that that the U.S. occupation is accountable for this action, just as it is accountable for the deaths of millions in Iraq. The language of collateral damage that was employed by the imperialist leadership that justified the war crimes that took place in Iraq also could have been obfuscated to signify that, the deaths of millions of Iraqis and of countless civilians, children, women, did constitute a non-intentional attack, but nonetheless, it was the direct result of an illegal occupation that involved brutal force against a civilian population, and this is no different.
Well, so a 15-year-old Iraqi teenager, her name is Zainab Isam al-Khazali, she was killed by a stray bullet in her own father's field, yet people might not have even heard of her name before now, before even watching this show right now, or the events that actually led to her murder, because international media, they did not only black out on the story, they were busy broadcasting regime change propaganda against the Islamic Republic of Iran. How do you assess the hypocrisy of the media, especially in a case like this one, a clear-cut case?
Right, and it's absolutely necessary that Zainab Isam's name in her case is obscured, so that while the media is propagating the narrative of the evil Iranian regime that is just brutalizing women and is directly responsible for the death of Miss Amini, which anybody has access to the footage. It was widely broadcasted. It's available. It clearly shows that there was no evidence of beating. But that narrative had to take precedent in order to justify the imperialist feminist push to again demonize Iran and launch this narrative as in attempts to launch another soft war, color revolution campaign. And to have this occur simultaneously with the death of Zainab Isam, it's not possible because people had to, the consent for imperialism had to be manufactured. So to have these stories heard and broadcasted simultaneously would present a contradiction in the imperialist narrative that would also, that would hold the U.S. accountable for it's for the death of Zainab Khadil, but at the same time wants to hone in on focusing on holding, manufacturing a narrative around the Iranian government of its supposed legitimacy and its brutality, particularly against women, which is a very, very common and recurring trope in U.S. propaganda and Western propaganda against Iran. And again, in one case, it was very obvious who were the culprits of the killing of Zainab Isam were. But in the second case, the putting the Iranian government to blame and the Iranian officer and manufacturing this narrative of brutality was construed. It was obviously a narrative pushed without an absence of evidence. Mm-hmm. Now, whether it was the case that she died in police custody or was affected by the stress due to her
chronic disease, she had chronic disease before.
Right. Right.
So that's basically the fingers of accusations are directed in Iraq against the occupation forces, the American occupation forces, unlike what they are propagating about Ms. Mahsa Amini in Tehran. But they did not provide a justification or an explanation for what they did to Zainab al-Khazali. Although Iraqi politicians and bloggers accused the American forces of killing Zainab, and they demanded an investigation of this murder that happened, but no country denounced, nor was the voice of the United States of America heard, nor did the United Nations portray its concern that it usually portrays against anything that's going on in West Asia, or any of the Western countries even heard about Zainab. I know it's not a matter of geography here, rather of interest and of responsibility, but will Iraq be able to hold those responsible accountable to the murder, to the treacherous and coward crime that they committed against a young 15-year-old Iraqi teenager?
Right, and just to finish up the last point, the Iranian government is constantly asked itself to, is constantly demanded to hold itself accountable in the context of its constant demonization, despite actually an investigation being ordered by the president and the security carrying it out right away. In the case of Iraq, while there has been investigation demanded, the U.S. first of all wants to maintain its impunity in its role in causing countless Iraqi deaths, including this one, which is no different. But the U.S.'s continued intervention into Iraq also keeps there from being a government that's able to hold it accountable. In 2019, the resistance forces in Iraq, which represented a significant segment of the elected body, we're trying to form and consolidate a government that would be able to hold the U.S. accountable and remove the U.S. Out of Iraq. But of course, the U.S. came in and incited a color revolution in Iraq that was designed to prevent that from happening. And we're seeing the effects of that right now, of how justice and accountability cannot be attained for Zainab Issa. The U.S. wants to retain its impunity in the countless deaths around the world, intentional deaths that it caused. And this is Amini's death is a convenient way for it to deflect responsibility and push a narrative that further obscures its role in actually imposing its occupation, its will, its hegemony around the world intentionally and through systematic violence and force.
But this is why we are here, mm-hmm. Julia. We are here to make the world listen and hear our voices and know that a young Iraqi girl named Zainab Issam al-Khaz'ali, she was killed, brutally killed by a bullet from a military base, an illegal military base inside of the sovereign Iraqi state and international airport. Julia Qasim, journalist and political commentator, I want to thank you very much for your contribution and for helping us raise the voices of those who are voiceless and who are oppressed because of the occupation and the presence of imperialist powers in our nations and killing us, the natives of West Asia. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The emergence of Giorgia Meloni as the new Prime Minister of Italy brings to everybody's mind the return of fascism to Italy. Critics believe the United States has opened the door for the return of fascism to Italy. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the first part. The website of Common Dreams wrote, with the help of people like Steve Bannon, Meloni was able to rise like a toxic slime on the surface of a sea of contaminated waste. The Italian parliamentary election has concluded and the neo-fascist Giorgia Meloni is ready to emerge as the new prime minister of a divided country with no clear mandate from around 60% of eligible voters in one of the lower voter turnouts in history. The choices were quite grim, and the system reeked along the lines of anti-democratic U.S. election model after years of neoliberal forces working to create a bipolar, schizophrenic, and easily destabilized political system. Berlusconianism, the creation of a disastrous neoliberal and U.S.-NATO-controlled Democratic Party modeled after the United States' own corporate-driven party, coupled with a general malaise and degradation of Italian culture, overall have contributed to create the ingredients for the Steve Bannon-groomed Meloni to rise to the top, like a toxic slime on the surface of a sea of contaminated waste. Italy has become like a country of spoiled children that has lost its identity. It has been colonized by multinational corporate interest, the mythological concept of the American dream, mass consumerism, US-NATO dictated militarism, and crass materialism. For almost 30 years, from Berlusconi's first election in 1994, and even going back to the post-Second World War era, when the United States asserted its sphere of influence by steamrolling an anti-communist agenda in order to maintain geopolitical control over the peninsula, Italy has been slowly but steadily pulling out its historical roots and erasing its historical memory. Giorgia Meloni is the aggressive, bombastic, volatile, and narcissistic woman that leads the far-right, racist, anti-immigrant, Italian-first neo-fascist party called Fratelli d'Italia, meaning Brothers of Italy. Several of her party's candidates have been arrested for corruption scandals as recently as last week, and it is a political party with strong ties to Italy's organized criminality. The other political choices have inspired little to no enthusiasm after the technocratic center-right neoliberal disaster led by the former president of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, whose coalition government included components from all strips of the Italian political spectrum, from the populist five-star movement to the xenophobic Liga with the Democratic Party, and always more incoherent Berlusconi and his Forza Italia in between. Meloni's popularity, with around 25% support from the electorate, is based on her fiery rhetoric and sloganeering, feeding on the spiraling discontent of an increasingly ignorant populace. Wages have been stagnant for decades. The post-COVID-19 bailouts from the EU are drying up, and the cost of everything is on the rise in Italy. The Italian people are suffering a major increase in economic hardship from the criminal and stratospheric rise of energy prices, leading to crippling inflation across the board, all compounded by the disastrous war in Eastern Europe, where Italy does whatever the United States government dictates. This has allowed for Meloni to ride a populist wave of anger, as her political party strategically positioned itself as the opposition to the unfolding neoliberal disaster that has set the Italian and European economy back decades. There is the green Italian left that has a broad-based social democratic platform based on a socially just ecological transition. However, they are schizophrenically aligned with the Democratic Party, whose leadership openly declared that they were only in coalition with them for useful votes to defeat the threat of Meloni, and that they would then again push the neoliberal NATO-dominated Draghi agenda and largely ignore their green left counterparts. Then there is Union Popular, or Popular Union, that has a broad-based transformative program led by former mayors of Naples, Luigi Do, Magistris, though they were lucky to get 1% of the vote. Recently, they garnered the support of Ken Loach, an embattled former pro-immigrant mayor of Reyes, Dominica Lucano, but their campaign has been barely perceptible. And then there is the newly reorganized five-star movement, now led by former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, which has splintered with the components that were supportive of the Draghi neoliberal agenda. But after Five Star's meteoric populist rise a decade ago, it has proven to be an incoherent and hypocritical fluff in implementing any effective policies and has betrayed its promise of political purity by forming coalitions with parties from across the entire political spectrum, from the far right to the extreme center, in order to maintain its political survival. Another political alliance that has developed is the former prime minister and former leader of the Democratic Party, Matteo Renzi, and a newer crook on the scene named Carlo Calenda, who is a senator and recent candidate for mayor of Roma. Renzi's political party Italia Viva caused the fall of the popular Conte government at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, and Calenda considers himself a liberal globalist. This pair like to depict themselves as the grand center representing a Clintonesque approach to governance. Renzi is known for his shady alliances with the House of Saud and a series of corruption scandals that have made him quite unpopular. This alliance has the tendency to serve U.S. interests at all costs and push a neoliberal agenda that favors corporate-driven reform. For example of their backwardness, Calenda, embracing a false narrative of ecological transition, has called for building of nuclear power plants across Peninsula to help confront the newly created energy crisis. So, in coalition with Berlusconi's Forza Italia and Matteo Salvini's xenophobic Lega, Meloni and the Brothers of Italy have received around 45% of the vote. Meloni's party is likely to earn around 25%, making Fratelli d'Italia the most popular party in Italy and ensuring that Meloni will become the first woman prime minister of the country.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Finally, Iran accedes to the Shanghai Cooperation Council, SCO, as full member. It's part profit and part potential, as this Eurasian alliance that was forged in 2001 is still establishing new memberships and laying out the infrastructure to obtain its goals.
Our question is, what will be Iran's role in the SCO's achieving its goals, and what will permanent membership do for Iran? Well, the Transcontinental Political Security and Economic Alliance does comprise over 40% of the world's population and just under 30% of its GDP, gross domestic product. And Iran, a major supplier of fossil fuels, is placed strategically on the North-South Corridor and the East-West Corridor. Welcome to Iran Today with me, Leila Faramarzi.
Now, Iran had applied for full membership 15 years ago. So why the upgrade from observer status now? The JCPOA and Iran seemingly prioritizing the West in its foreign policy decisions seems to have been a problem. Although the two greatest powers on the SCO, that's Russia and China, are also party to the JCPOA. Anyhow, now with the JCPOA or nuclear deal struggling to survive and Iran looking to the East and neighborly relations for leverage and balance, it has qualified as a suitable candidate for SCO permanent membership. Also, Russia and China are at odds with America now. The Russia-Ukraine war is a rift between Russia and the West in total. And China is also sanctioned by the US, the US which interferes in overseas regions, creating turmoil. So now the East is closing ranks in securing its own interests. We got to have a chat with the Foreign Ministry spokesman, Mr. Kanani, busy as he is with the many alliances Iran has been forging or amending. That was at the ministry's exquisite conference hall with mirror and plasterwork.
We should not forget that at any rate we are witnessing regional alliances that are faced against globalist policies. Fortunately, this organization can challenge the unilateral policies of the United States. Member states are generally aligned with the same policies, including China and Russia. In this policy, we see similarities between the Islamic Republic of Iran and significant members of the organization, including China. Therefore, membership in the SCO can be a mutual bilateral opportunity both for the Islamic Republic and the SCO as an international organization observing regional politics.
Not to forget, Iran's permanent membership, which was confirmed at the 22nd SCO summit in Uzbekistan, is to be finalized in April of 2023. Now, the SCO doesn't want trouble, and while Iran's membership can neutralize the adverse effects of sanctions partially, I wondered whether sanctions prevailing might reverse Iran's status in the club by that time. For the time being, full membership will give this country some leverage and clout in ongoing Vienna talks for a more favorable JCPOA in the re-signing. Mr. Vafoy is a university professor, informed, meticulous and accurate in studying and teaching, all to do with Iran-Asia relations.
The imposition of sanctions does not hinder the organization's progress at all. In fact, it can neutralize some of its adverse effects. The reason is multilateralism, which is the motto of the organization, and the capabilities of its member states. When countries like India, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Pakistan are showing interest in joining the organization, it shows that the organization holds the potential to establish anti-sanctions measures.
The alliance has an interesting composition. It was formed 21 years ago by Russia, China, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan at a summit held in Shanghai. All our regional member states are WTO, World Trade Organization members, except for Uzbekistan. The SCO has four nuclear powers for member, and two greatest fossil fuel powers, Russia and Iran, and two great energy consumers, India and China, to buy from them. Now that they are all equal SCO partners, they can equally establish cooperation for energy transactions.
The organization is a suitable bed for multilateral as well as bilateral transactions and cooperation, because primarily it's not a trade organization, but energy security is of paramount importance for these countries, which are major providers or producers of energy. And this is where Iran's importance is highlighted, for energy and security.
The SCO is a very large international collective that creates mutual opportunities for the Islamic Republic and the member states. Well, the collective of the SCO member states add up to more than 25% of the gross domestic production of the entire world. Roughly 40% of the population belong to the SCO member states. Therefore, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is a substantial economic opportunity and is a vast market. markets. In the framework of the SCO membership, there will naturally be ample opportunities for its member states, including the IRI, especially in the context of regionalist and eastward policies of the Islamic Republic. The SCO is a very good opportunity to employ SCO capacities in line with its own interests and benefit, despite Iran-West relations.
Trade can be furthered and secured, with transit and energy security heightened as a consequence of this alliance that creates multilateralism in the world, hence breaking a U.S. hegemony and unilateralism. Even the issue of security is not dryly about guarding oil wells at gunpoint. SCO meetings have heard a range of issues discussed. The issue of food security, for one, has been emphasized. President Raisi himself emphasized issues such as health and the use of Iran's capabilities in that field, including the export of medical equipment and biotechnological drugs, as well as providing health tourism services to SCO member states by this country.
Given the main goal of the SCO is security, how do you see Iran's membership helping regional security?
Security is one of the chief concerns of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Unfortunately, our region is generally home to many tensions and challenges. We witness new crises rise and old ones rekindled. The Islamic Republic has shown that it holds effective and serious potential in helping solve regional conflicts and strengthening political proceedings to deal with regional challenges.
Talking of trade, there are subordinate organizations to the SCO which might help boost member states' economy, such as the Business Council, Interbanking Association, or Energy Club. The SCO Business Council, founded in 2006, is a non-governmental body which brings together the most influential members of the business communities of member countries. It aims to boost economic cooperation in the framework of the organization. It gives expert assessments on the involvement of members of business communities of the SCO member states in trade, economic and investment interaction, again in the framework of the organization.
For example, Central Asian countries and China have defined well-established economic relations, but these relations require infrastructure. The member states will be willing to work in the framework I mentioned, both bilateral and multilateral. But if we have an issue with an SCO member, for example, and we expect multilateral relations to work, we'll hit a dead end.
In 2005, SCO heads of the Government Council decided to establish the SCO Interbank Consortium, what would translate as Interbanking Association in Persian. That was mainly to set up a mechanism of funding and banking services for investment projects supported by the governments of the SCO member states. Now, specifically for energy cooperation between members, the SCO Energy Club was founded in 2013. And since, apart from multilateral arrangements, members have also engaged in bilateral agreements in the energy sector. China and Russia have been building a natural gas pipeline since 2015, a pipeline under 3,400 kilometers long. That's the largest energy cooperation between the two countries. CGTN, Chinese television, put it in good terms. The SCO has been an incubator for regional synergy in the field of energy. Mr. Sonny is an enterprising youth who shared his experience and insight with us. He is deputy chair of the Iran-Uzbekistan Joint Chamber of Commerce, with a healthy interest in introducing Uzbek opportunities.
According to the structure in the SCO, below the heads of states and ministers of foreign affairs, the secretariat is performing the activities. The secretariat is formed of permanent entities such as a consortium monitoring banking and financial transactions. This consortium is made up of a few banks that are from the SCO member states. One of the new plans of the consortium that they insist on realizing by 2026 is using the national currencies of the SCO member states and not relying on common currencies such as the dollar.
Some SCO projects being implemented are related to free trade zones and the Green Belt. Iran has several important ports and free trade zones, including the Chabahar port on the Oman Sea, which can connect Caspian states to the open warm waters of the south, among numerous other uses it has. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. This